From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, First Man is about Neil Armstrong going to the moon. La La Land's Damien Chazelle directed the film, and Josh Singer from Spotlight wrote it. Singer wanted to show the series of setbacks that led to the lunar landing.
By not showing the failures, we think, oh, well, it came easy. And there were these superheroes who just did it. When in actuality, it was normal men and women working very, very hard, sacrificing, failing. That's how it got done.
And live theater in Watts speaks to social issues. All that coming up today on The Frame.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
On June 20th, 1969, Neil Armstrong stepped out on the ladder of the Apollo 11 spacecraft, which had landed on the surface of the moon. As he talked with engineers back at NASA and the world watched on television, or like me, listened on the radio, Armstrong became the first person on the moon.
I'm going to step off the land now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
So how do you make a movie about Neil Armstrong and his journey when everyone already knows its ending? That was the challenge for director Damien Chazelle and screenwriter Josh Singer when they set about making First Man. The film stars Ryan Gosling as Armstrong. I spoke with Chazelle and Singer at the Telluride Film Festival, where First Man premiered in the States. Here's Damien Chazelle.
We wanted to tell the story behind that story, basically. We know that he landed on the moon, but I don't think people really know or perhaps appreciate how he got there and how difficult it was and how costly it was, not just to him, but to his family, to the people he knew, and then I think by extension to the country and to the world. I mean, this was not an achievement that came easily. So I think what really fascinated me at the outset was taking one of the most famous achievements in history, one that we just think of as a success story, a sort of fait accompli. You grow up, you see the photos, and you hear the one-liners, and you kind of soak in the mythology, but try to take that rewind to when none of that stuff had happened, when it all seemed actually quite ludicrous and crazy to a bunch of people, and trace step by step how this fantasy was turned into reality and just what the sacrifices involved were.
Josh, Neil was famously private. He didn't like talking at all about himself, but he did cooperate with one author about a book, James Hansen, on the book First Man. And that gives you a lot of information. But where do you go beyond that? What does the book leave out? Where do you go to do additional research that builds on what he shared with Hansen in that biography?
Yeah, so, I mean, Jim really did yeoman's work. And his book is encyclopedic. And what's amazing is as you dive deeper and deeper, there are just incredible chestnuts he uncovered that a lot of people didn't know. Most of the people who worked with Neil never knew he had a daughter. Most of the people who worked with Neil didn't know that, you know, he struggled a bit with the X-15 right around when Karen died. So there was just, they were right off the bat, Jim's work was just an incredible starting point. But it's true, we wanted to go deeper. And first of all, we had Jim himself. He had a ton of knowledge. He had his own original notes from his conversations with Neil and Janet and all sorts of other folks. But he also put us in touch with a ton of people. I think the first month I started working on this, I took a trip up to Edwards to what's now Armstrong Flight Research Center, which at the time was just, you know, the NASA Flight Research Center, where Neil had flown the X-15. You know, within 5 minutes, I was sitting down with Gene Matranga, who was one of the engineers who had worked closely with Neil on the X-15. And NASA and Jim just opened these doors for us at Johnson, tons of former astronauts. We met this fellow, Frank Hughes, who turned out to be invaluable. He retired as head of training for the NASA astronauts and basically was our head of training and taught us a ton about the Gemini craft, the Apollo craft. And then Neil's family. We got to sit with Janet. We got to talk to June, Neil's sister, who was probably one of the closer people in the world to him. And his kids, Rick and Mark, were just incredibly supportive. And, you know, all of these people not only gave us primary information, but then read draft upon draft upon draft and gave us notes, which was incredibly helpful.
Damien, a lot of people who have paid attention to the space program over the last 20 or 30 years imagine that it's really dangerous because of the Challenger and the Columbia accidents. But until the Challenger accident in 1986, no American astronaut had died in space. The Apollo fire that killed Roger Chaffee, Gus Grissom, and Ed White in 1967 was on the launch pad, but test pilots were really risking their lives every time they got inside a vehicle. And I think a lot of people don't really understand that what Neil Armstrong was doing before he became an astronaut was far more dangerous than what astronauts were doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's sort of, you have to look at the percentage. You know, obviously there's less space flights, so less percentage of, I mean, it's hard to say that being a test pilot at that time was actually more dangerous than being an astronaut. Basically, I think the key is just that it was one was an extension of the other, that these were all former test pilots, or almost all former test pilots. These also were all former, almost all former wartime pilots. So it's true that everyone, not just Neil, but everyone around him in those first groups of astronauts in the early 60s, they came into that program with the great awareness of their proximity to death at all times on this job. And I think that became really fascinating to me, was just how they coped with that, how they dealt with it. Felt like a lot of them dealt with it by modern standards, by not dealing with it. But, you know, how do you kind of do a day-by-day job that, you know, whether you're an astronaut or a test pilot, that in many ways could seem like a normal middle-class kind of job? These astronauts and their families lived seemingly normal middle-class lives, with the exception that every time they went off on a flight or a mission, or often training, we often forget how many astronauts died training, some of which we go into in the film. How do you deal with the fact that you may not ever come back? How do you deal with those odds? How do you deal with, how does your family deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of training, you know, there's a great engineering saying, which is that engineering is the obviation of failure, which means you fail and fail and you fail so that eventually you succeed. And that's the whole point of training, is failing down here so we don't fail up there. But failing down here costs lives. Neil was in the second astronaut group, the new nine. There were nine guys. Two of them died, right? And those two turned out to be the two that Neil was closest with, which, again, I think not many people knew. But those aren't great odds, you know? So, sure, you know, test pilots, there were some brutal years, but there were also plenty of brutal years for these guys.
Coming up, why director Damien Chazelle and writer Josh Singer didn't want to show Neil Armstrong and his fellow astronauts as stock Hollywood heroes in their movie First Man. Let's get back now to my conversation with director Damien Chazelle and screenwriter Josh Singer about the Neil Armstrong film First Man. The movie is not only about the moon landing, but also Armstrong's personal life and the death of his daughter at a young age. Director Damien Chazelle explains why that loss became a central part of his movie.
One of the things I find the most fascinating about Neil was this reluctance or even failure to express or talk about his emotions or things, you know, traumas like this that he had been through, in the culture of the astronauts and test pilots. And I think it's one of the coping mechanisms that they sort of relied on, especially people of that era. There was this unwillingness to go there. And the way you sort of managed those feelings was to kind of tuck them away and put them somewhere in the attic of your brain. But to me, actually, there's something profoundly tragic, poignant, and cinematic about someone who, the only way he can cope with those feelings that he tucks away up in the attic of his brain is through his work, is through flying, is through this sort of wordless pursuit of things that he can't even quite articulate. I love the fact that, you know, if you were to actually even ask Neil, why do you do test piloting and why are you going to the moon, he would give you answers that were very much, you know, sort of engineer's answers. It was always about problem solving and about, you know, kind of trying to figure out how things worked.
I don't know what space exploration will uncover, but I don't think it'll be exploration just for the sake of exploration. I think it'll be more the fact that it allows us to see things that maybe we should have seen a long time ago, but just haven't been able to until now.
What I find fascinating is none of his answers would ever quite answer But why risk your life? Why do these things? Why instead of just sitting at an engineering, you know, drawing pad and kind of working out the numbers, why put yourself in the line where you yourself are part of that equation? And if the equation goes south, you go south. So I think Josh and I just became very quickly fascinated about what drives someone to do that and what the unsaid things in that person's mind and feelings, what those are that drive them.
Does anyone have anything else?
Yeah. Neil, I was sorry to hear about your daughter.
I'm sorry, is there a question?
What I mean is, do you think it will have an effect?
I think it would be unreasonable to assume that it wouldn't have some effect.
You know, because the myth has become so set in stone in some ways, of these guys and how they behaved, you know, I think it almost suggests that they didn't feel, right? We heard a lot like, oh, people would, you know, they'd be at funerals and they'd check their watch. When could we get back to work? And Robert Perlman, who was one of our great advisors, he said, when I saw Neil crying, you know, after Karen dies, it totally changed my perception of who Neil was. I'd never thought of that guy. And obviously, Neil would cry when his daughter dies, right? And he does it in a very Neil way, you know. But I think, you know, trying to get underneath the myth, trying to puncture that myth. And I think that's why, you know, focusing on the loss and the tragedy and the sacrifice was so important to us.
I think it was also, just to jump in, one thing that was super important to Ryan. I think I was looking at this story primarily as a story about a goal and the cost of a goal, sort of what you're running to as opposed to what you're running from. And Ryan, I think, more than anything, sort of gravitated towards what Neil was running from. It was actually Ryan, I think, who pushed us to show Neil actually immediately a moat in a sort of outward way, even though it's very hidden from everyone else, upon the death of his daughter, and to kind of try to create a sort of primal scene there that's going to drive you eventually to the moon. And I think that actually became that sort of balance between the emotions you show, the emotions you don't show, the astronaut culture that suppresses all those emotions, and then the realities of being a father, being a husband. That became actually the big emotional balancing act for all of us, for me, Ryan, Josh, all of us making the film, constantly threading that needle, because he's such an introverted guy, because this is a culture that is about that kind of introversion. How do you then stay truthful to what it actually means to lose a child?
We're talking with Damien Chazelle, the director of First Man, and Josh Singer, the film screenwriter. The other thing you're doing is kind of examining this whole idea of what is heroism and how uncomfortable Neil was with that idea and how, I think, ambivalent your film is about heroism, that these are people who don't see themselves as heroes. They are doing a job, and you don't want to fall into the typical pop culture way that we want to set people up at such an unbelievably high level that they're beyond understanding.
That applies to Neil in a way. It also applied, I think, to how we wanted to attack the whole subject matter, because there's even a way in which NASA at that period in history is so gilded in retrospect. I often think of, you know, how would we today discuss that period in our history if, which could have very easily happened, we had never landed on the moon. It had never worked out. You know, I think we would cast a very critical eye on things that now I think have almost become a little bit sort of warmed by the afterglow of the success, you know. So one thing that Josh said very early on that kind of stuck in my mind is like a mantra for the movie. This is a movie that, sure, our subject is the greatest success in American history. This is a movie about failure. This is a movie about all the failures that led to that success.
Yeah, I think it's really important in this day and age. You know, we have so many great big challenges that we face as humans right now. I think climate change is a good example of that, where it seems like this impossible problem. How are we ever going to fix it? And I think in some ways the myth around NASA has done us a bit of a disservice, because by sugarcoating everything, by not showing the failures and focusing on the failures and the loss and the sacrifice, we think, oh, well, it came easy. And there were these superheroes who just did it. And that's how it gets done. When in actuality, it was normal men and women working very, very hard, sacrificing, failing, right? That's how it got done. And to me, that's more inspiring, because it tells me, like, okay, I'm going to have to sacrifice. We're all going to have to sacrifice, like, you know, in order to solve these problems.
Josh, I'm going to ask you about Neil Armstrong's first wife, Janet, who's played by Claire Foy in the film. What was important about their story that you thought was critical to the film?
Well, my wife, who's the real writer in the family, she's a wonderful novelist, and she's always my emotional center, you know. And she talked about how there's something about their relationship where it seems like they really were quite loving, you know, and really loved each other. I mean, they lived up in this little cabin up in Juniper Hills when Neil was flying out at Edwards. And, you know, it had like, it didn't have a washing machine. It didn't have hot water, you know, and they loved it. Right, which just sort of says it's the almost idyllic, which is how Damien and Linus beautifully shoot it in the movie. But, you know, and it goes from there to where they eventually, you know, later in the 90s, divorce, right? And so many of these families divorced. And what my wife would say was, you know, it's like how many blows can love sustain? They have real love, but these blows, one after another after another.
Jen, you have to trust us. We've got this under control.
No, you don't. All these protocols and procedures to make it seem like you have it under control. But you're a bunch of boys making models out of balsa wood. You don't have anything under control.
It just takes such a toll. And seeing that love fracture, seeing them, you know, sort of forced apart both by these tragedies and by the demands of the job, that arc wound up being, I think, really very important to us.
Damien, the astronauts at this time were all white men. Almost everybody who ran NASA at the time was a white man. There were some people in Mission Control who might have been African American. But at the time that this is all happening, Vietnam War is going on. There are still very important civil rights battles that are being fought. And you stop the movie for a little bit and look at those issues. Why was it important to frame what all these white guys were doing in the context of what was happening in the rest of the country at the time?
One thing I just didn't know much at all before I started researching this movie about the space program was how controversial it was, especially in that latter part of the 60s. Obviously, 69, when they actually landed on the moon, if you look at the kind of chart, approval rating chart, there's a spike, a big spike at that moment, but everything before then, and then quite quickly after, was very divided, hovering around 50%, if not much lower, for the expenditure and the whole idea of the space program. Why are we sending men to the moon while we're trying to send men to the moon, because again, we hadn't even done it yet, while people can't eat, while cities are burning, and while, you know, people are being sent off to die in Vietnam. And that was the other fascinating thing to me, was actually in the ways in which, for certain commentators at the time, Vietnam and the space program were actually part of the same equation. There's the same military-industrial equation. It's all about, hey, the Saturn rocket looks a lot like a bomb, and it goes off like a bomb, you know? And I think the irony of that was something that Josh and I wanted to certainly comment on. I just think it makes it much more interesting in a way to, instead of sugarcoating that stuff, to really try to look at it, try to contextualize Neil and his sort of bubble of the community against that backdrop. It just puts it in perspective in a way that, again, I think is important to have a full understanding of what this experience was.
Josh and Damien, great to see you. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
First Man opens on October 12th. Coming up on The Frame, a little-known theater at a community center in Watts is getting a new life. A group of artists concerned about racism and gun violence in America has banded together to help residents of Watts explore those and other tough topics. The LA company Rogue Machine Theater hopes that storytelling on a stage can ease some of the fear and frustration. Frame contributor Marcos Najera has the story on the company's new play called Gunshot Medley.
In South LA, most people already know that the Watts Labor Community Action Center is the place to find classes, workshops, and even a skate park. But few people know it has a theater space tucked far away in a corner of the campus.
Hi, ladies. It's all the way in the back.
Oh, all right.
How are you doing? So you go right.
But if a certain group of creative folks have their way, the center, as it's known, will become a regular place to see shows.
So are the books for sale?
No, these are your complimentary programs for admission. Do you need change? Thank you so much. Thanks for coming out.
The Collaborative Artist Block is a collective of writers, actors, and designers, many from the Rogue Machine Company, who want to mount new work that explores social justice issues and cultural identity in underserved communities. Working together, the Collaborative Artist Block and Rogue Machine have set up shop in Watts this month to present this show called Gunshot Medley Part 1.
Betty!
Quit your hollering, Elvis. You trying to raise the dead?
Betty, girl, you're so silly. You of all people know the dead don't need raising. They around all the time.
These artists say while there is a rich history of visual art in South LA, they want to help boost access to the performing arts.
We are in a special time in history.
Here's show director Deshaun Terry.
One of the things we have to do is that we have to look to the past.
Bones to the center. You know what type I'm talking about.
By us remembering, you know, all these things and seeing what the past has done.
Well, just keep it down. I don't want to hear George mouth today. You want to make him mad again?
I ain't scared of George.
I think we need to be louder. I think that specifically as artists, socially and politically, you know, that's a particular thing that is of passion to me. And I hope that other artists, you know, listen to the call.
That's exactly what Terry did. He literally put out a call to artists on Facebook. In an online post that was a want ad of sorts, Terry said he was looking for a playwright who'd be willing to pen a script about race relations and firearms.
Black is the color of my true love's hair.
Deanna Michelle Daniel answered his call.
Yeah, so I was in my hometown of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and I was walking in the cemetery with my mentor, Nathan Ross Freeman. And before that, it was actually around the time of the Charleston church shootings. And because of that, it really hit the hardest for me, I feel, because I was in North Carolina at the time. And, you know, I was angry, I was hurt.
His face, so soft and wondrous fair.
We were walking and we saw that somebody had placed little Confederate flags on the graves of Confederate soldiers. And because of that, I was flustered, I was angry, and my mentor said, hey, let me, have you seen the slave graves? And I was like, no.
The purest eyes.
And I've been to the cemetery in North Carolina many times before and never knew that slaves were buried there. And so we like literally hopped over some bushes and they were hidden from the rest of the cemetery. And I found these three stones, Betty, Alvis, and George.
And the strongest hands.
Daniel says her anger about gun violence, coupled with the national debate over Confederate flags and statues, fueled her fire to write the stories of those three forgotten slaves. She describes it as a Black Lives Matter story from slavery to now.
Well, that's what I was about to explain to you.
You know what you should have been out there doing?
What this time, Betty? What should I have been doing?
Keeping a close eye on that boy, that's what.
She set the story back in that North Carolina graveyard where she came across those slave gravestones. On stage, we get to hear about the fate of Betty, Alvis, and George.
I know you don't believe me, but I'm going to help her bring the storm. I'm going to help her deliver.
We actually pop in on their lives, or afterlives as it were, multiple times. The music changes, but their circumstances never do. The trio can never seem to escape the dangers of being killed by a gun, no matter the entry point on America's history timeline. These theater artists say they know their story can't solve the issue of gun violence here in South LA, or anywhere in the country for that matter. But the goal, says Watts resident and show producer Bruce Lemon, is to make sure people know that art is another tool to help craft some possible solutions to a seemingly impossible problem.
Let's bring it to the community. Let's make it happen so it's a regular thing so that the kids around the corner can come in here and see themselves represented on stage. But nobody's going to know that unless they have the experience.
It scared me.
For Denise Perkins, this play was personal because she had just learned news of her nephew.
I just lost a nephew tonight.
Tonight?
Tonight.
What happened?
My sister, son. I don't know if it was a drive-by, but he was shot, gunned down.
I'm so sorry about that.
I got to see her first to see what's going on. But I had to come on here, you know, because it's a bunch of ignorance. I mean, life's too short for that.
Hey, you know Roland in My Sweet Baby's Arms?
No.
Ooh, well, I ain't gonna work on the railroad.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
Rogue Machine's Gunshot Medley runs October 12th through the 14th at the Watts Labor Community Action Center. And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. We'll be back here tomorrow. My sweet baby's arms. Hey, roll in my sweet baby's arms. Don't lay around my shack till the mail train come back. And roll in my sweet baby's arms.